The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Andrew Essex, author of The End of Advertising, Why It Had to Die and the Creative Resurrection to Come, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, which was named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. My goal for this podcast is to help you discover new ideas about what's actually working in modern marketing and sales. And don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com, which is also where you can sign up for the Marketing Book Podcast newsletter so you never miss an episode. This episode of the Marketing Book Podcast is sponsored by Content Marketing World 2017 this September. I'm going to be there. How about you? Content Marketing World is the one event where you can learn and network with the best and brightest in the content marketing industry, including several authors who have been guests on the Marketing Book Podcast. You will leave the conference with all the materials you need to take a content marketing strategy back to your team and to implement a content marketing plan that will grow your business. To register and get the best price, do two things. First, go to marketingbookpodcast.com and click on the Content Marketing World banner. Make sure to go through marketingbookpodcast.com so they'll know I sent you. Seriously, there's a bottle of scotch in it for me for everyone who registers through marketingbookpodcast.com. Then, for the lowest price, when you register, make sure to use promo code MARKETINGBOOK and they'll knock $100 off your ticket price. $100. Think about it. That's $100 you can spend buying both of us drinks once you get there and still have money left over. I'll have more details after the interview. Today, we welcome Andrew Essex to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his new book, The End of Advertising, Why It Had to Die and the Creative Resurrection to Come. Andrew Essex is the Chief Executive Officer of Tribeca Enterprises, the parent company of Tribeca Film Festival. Until 2015, he was the Chairman and Founding CEO of the advertising agency Droga5, which won multiple awards under his leadership and was commended for its creative campaigns. Andrew was the Executive Editor of Details Magazine and later served as Editor-in-Chief of Absolute Magazine. His writing has been published in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, Rolling Stone, Outside, and several other magazines. And of great interest to the listeners of the Marketing Book Podcast, he has co-authored three other books, Le Freak, an upside-down story of family, disco, and destiny with Nile Rodgers, Chasing Cool, standing out in today's cluttered marketplace with Noah Kerner and Gene Pressman, and A Very Public Offering, a rebel story of business success, and reckoning with Stephen Paternotte. Andrew has served as a television commentator for ABC, CNN, Anderson Cooper, The View, and Fox News, and he is a frequent public speaker on media and marketing strategies. And interesting fact, he is not a big fan of Jägermeister. Andrew, congratulations on The End of Advertising and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks very much. Thank you.
So we'll get to the Jägermeister story later. But, you know, when I was 12 years old, we went to New York City, the first time I'd ever been there, and we stayed at the Essex House. You should be so proud of what your family's done.
Thank you. We're very proud of that in the little county in New Jersey.
Right. Very good. Very good. Well, Andrew, I just have to say, I loved the book. And you're probably the 127th book that's been on the show. And the book is different from a lot of ones that have been on there, but I couldn't put it down. And I don't think that I've read a more entertaining book for the show than yours. And I haven't been this entertained since reading Disrupted by Dan Lyons. I don't know if you've read that book. A very, very, very different book. It's about his world, life in the startup world, but it was thoroughly enjoyable. And it may have been, you know, in part because I love reading these kind of books, but I had worked at big agencies in New York for 10 years, just before you got into the ad game. I I was at J. Walter Thompson and Gray, and I had maybe a special insight some of the things you were talking about. But in recent years, I'll give a talk every once in a while, and I'll say, you know, things have changed, and that really doesn't faze people. But then maybe I'll show them that famous slide of newspaper revenues from 1950 to 2012, which looks like a big cliff, or I'll tell them about the Bureau of Labor Statistics from 2002 to 2012. The number one declining job category out of 850 was advertising and promotion manager. So now I have this book to say, look, it's not me. Advertising has a big problem. So it was very well done, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. So let me start with an excerpt from page 13. And you talk about how earlier in the book you were in the magazine industry, and then you went into the advertising industry. And you describe this feeling you had. I'm just going to read this one piece. I was experiencing a painful feeling of deja vu. I realized that the same thing that had happened to the magazine industry was now happening to advertising. It was getting elbowed out. The industry was focusing myopically on content, and all around us, the context was crumbling. What was truly painful was the dawning realization, just as I'd seen with magazines, that traditional advertising was slowly but surely becoming obsolete. It was increasingly clear that advertising, at least as we'd come to know it, was inexorably headed down the path of the blacksmith and the typewriter business. So, Andrew, why are people turning away from advertising and in such great numbers?
It's a very good question, and I see it through the prism of my own family, which is where I begin. I was never a fan of focus groups, and then I had children. And if they represent the future, it's probably a reflection of future at scale. So I have a 9-year-old daughter, and she consumes content, that's what we used to call television, on a tablet or a phone, and she's essentially never seen an ad. This is because I used ad blocking software to keep her from pre-roll, which she hated, and because she ingests on-demand platforms and over-the-top platforms which don't have ad interruptions. So the surfaces on which ads used to appear are essentially being disappeared. It's the golden age of television, they tell us, and one of the reasons it's the golden age of television is because television doesn't have ad interruptions anymore. I'm talking about HBO, or Netflix, or Amazon Prime, anyone who's producing this kind of premium TV. So a lot of the old paradigm, which was rooted in interruption, is essentially going away, and that's taking traditional advertising with it.
You talk about how TV got better when advertising stopped spoiling it. One of the many phrases you used in the podcast was, explain what you mean by the command and control era of advertising.
We used to have this term called couch potato, which described a person who was sitting on their couch watching TV like a vegetable. They had no real options, and they had three networks to choose from. And because of that, it was permissible to interrupt these shows with these blocks. So command and control meant that essentially the networks commanded and controlled you to absorb their advertising. And it was thus for a good half century. It worked really well, and it made people a lot of money. But as I said, that model is essentially going away. Now, you could say that that's an elitist coastal position, but it's reflected in the behavior of a lot of young people, and it seems to be the direction that the entire consumer base is moving, that we don't have to put up passively with interruption anymore. We can choose these formats that are not ad interrupted, and they are a better experience to boot. And when that's the case, there's no looking back.
So you say that there's a lot of money to be lost and made from the end of traditional advertising. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, absolutely. The good news, or bad news, depending on where you're sitting, is that the advertising industry on a global basis is basically estimated to be somewhere between $600 billion and $1.2 trillion in spend. So I think of it as a lava flow. And the lava flow is being diverted into new channels. Where it ends up, nobody's 100% sure. If I had my druthers, I'd be cryogenically frozen for 5 years so someone could wake me up and let me know how it all turns out. But right now, there's a lot of experimentation going on, but the dawning realization is that the traditional models are less and less effective.
Mm-hmm. But what do you say to people who, advertisers who are saying, well, we've got to do something to get people's attention?
I say you're absolutely right. You have to do something to get people's attention. So what you used to do is interrupt and annoy them. And there were many people who argued that was the play, that you would bang someone over the head and they would remember you. I philosophically reject that position. I reject it from a position of moral certitude. I don't think that's where the money is. So I say to them, take that money and try to do something that adds value to people's lives. That might be to entertain them. It might be simply to make a better commercial. It might be to do nothing. It might be to make a movie. It might be to underwrite the arts. It might be to give people bicycles in a city in which they don't have access to them. But try to do something other than interrupt them with an annoying message they didn't ask to see.
Let's step back a bit, go back in history. Part of the book was a very entertaining trip down memory lane for those of us who've studied advertising and the history of advertising. And you mentioned that the last century of advertising has been a historic anomaly. And, and that its extinction was always in the forecast. How so?
Well, I think that certainly the last half century has been an anomaly. We have to think about where advertising began. So in many respects, it began with people wearing sandwich boards or hawking snake oil at the market. And then publishing came along, newspapers and magazines, and started to create this idea of an adjacency. There was an article and there was an ad next to it. And then we had radio, of course, and radio was a new format, just like Facebook was a new format. And then came television. And people weren't really sure how to put the ad into new formats. So when radio and television were in their infancy, early brands like Procter & Gamble made shows. That's how we got the soap opera. They made entertainment. And then other people in the ad world said, hey, it'd be more lucrative if we could put a bunch of brands into this process and interrupt. It's one of the reasons why TV came to resemble magazines with these random interruptions, why 60 Minutes is called a news magazine. So it was always a battle between producing something or interrupting something else. And the interrupting something else came to be the reigning model. And that's the only game we had in town for a good 50 years. But now, because of all this abundance, people are starting to question whether that was the correct model. And my thesis is that it was a mistake, that we made a big mistake for 50 years. And we will look back on it the way we look back on...
Bloodletting?
Bloodletting, top hats, right. Sandals and socks, and say... Wow, why did we do that? Why did we jam something in there that no one asked for? Uh-huh. And we are now looking at the repercussions of that, which I think, and the biggest reflection of that is the massive adoption of ad blocking software.
Is that what you meant when you said that radio gave birth to impertinent advertising? I think it was somebody from maybe Ford who said that back in the 30s.
Yeah. That, I guess radio was the first big new platform after years and years and years of the printed word. Going back to Gutenberg. So think about how revelatory it was, this new thing, this new theater of the mind. And the question was, how do you monetize it? Not any different than what Snapchat is going through. How do you monetize a new platform? And you could basically produce theater presented by the good people at Ivory Soap, or you could have your theater interrupted by the good people at Ivory Soap. Really two games in town. And sadly, the latter, which was more impertinent, came to be the reigning form.
Now, you mentioned that, interestingly, that many of the older forms of advertising, as you say, the really old ones, the older the better, make the most sense in our modern media world. Explain that.
Yeah, it's what's old is new again. So when I was a kid, there was a show called Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom. And we watched it religiously at my home, eating TV dinners. It was a nature show, and it just happened to be presented by an insurance company. There was GE Theater, which for a long time was the number 3 most popular show in America after Milton Berle's show and I Love Lucy. It was hosted by a guy named Ronald Reagan, and there were little tell plays. And at the end, it was brought to you by GE, and he might make a little announcement about what GE products did. In some respects, it's not unlike what podcasters are doing now. But brands made shows, and they underwrote them. And I think they made good shows and underwrote them. And I just think that's a much better model in which there's so much content that no one wants anything that's secondary.
Right. Well, one last question about history. Years ago, after I got out of the Army, I got hold of the book Ogilvy on Advertising, and it had a life-changing effect on me. I read it, and I said, holy cow, that's what I want to do. And sure enough, I ended up doing that. So David Ogilvy, arguably the titan of the 20th century advertising, we could argue, as ad people love to do, but what do you think he would think of the current state of advertising? And I think he must have passed away in the late 1990s.
Yeah, he didn't have the misfortune of seeing internet advertising. And I'm sort of on the fence about David Ogilvy because he was clearly a genius. He was one of the more erudite gentlemen to ever impact the industry, but he missed a few things, and he created a sort of a false promise that you could respect the consumer by being direct with them. But in many respects, he forgot that he was serving something that no one really wanted to see. And I think if you look at what's happened to internet advertising and display advertising and following people, stalking people around the web with data, I don't think that he would be pleased with where the industry had gone. And he would probably take some responsibility for that.
Mm-hmm. I think if he were still around, he would have figured something out.
Oh, I hope so.
I think that was great. Now, on to, okay, I said that was the last history question, but here's the last one.
Sure.
You said that in the book, big part about ad blocking, and it's the, you know, the latest in the long string of technological innovations that have positively reshaped human behavior, somewhere between the Gutenberg press and the typewriter. Why is ad blocking the greatest thing that has ever happened to the advertising industry?
I don't think that consumers ever had a technology that was overtly designed to block ads. You could argue that TiVo and DVRing was really just to record content. It did have the ability to skip over commercials, and that opened a door. But ad blocking is very clear in its intention. It's called ad blocking. And that
well named.
Right, exactly, right? That intentionality indicates that it has a purpose. And no one forced consumers to download this technology. And the fact that they are doing it at exponential numbers suggests that they have found a solution to a problem. And I just think it's one of those examples of a cat being let out of a bag. You look at ad blocking rates by verticals. So gaming, there's a disproportionate amount of blockers in the gaming world. All these people that want to have fun and are technologically savvy saying, I do not want to see something interrupting my experience that I didn't ask for. And I think it's a revolution. I think it's a revolutionary development in the business. And I think it would have existed, or had it existed before, people would have been using it.
Can you talk about the denial, the effect of this has? It seems like it's probably still going on.
Yeah. This is a thing that I've gotten into a few fights over. Please don't think that I'm trying to deprive revenue from entities that are ad supported. If you're in the publishing business and your business is ad supported, ad blocking is an existential threat. But if you try to block blockers, as many people have done with the so-called white labeling software, you are penalizing someone for expressing displeasure with your monetization strategy. And there are many who say, no, we must force people to see the ads, and denying what's happening from a behavioral perspective. And that's like, from my perspective, denying climate change. You can't put off what's happening. People are changing. People have access to technology. Don't penalize them for wanting a better experience. Provide them with a better experience. And it will require you to think about new monetization strategies, but that's life.
Yeah, there are other examples of things that you point to that have gone away. You know, the fax machine, the VCR.
Yeah.
You know, things like that.
You know,
nothing lasts forever, as you said.
That's right. I mean, shit happens. And I do think that this model is marked for extinction, and the strong will survive and evolve accordingly.
Now, a line that you had in the book several times, which really resonated with me, is you said that advertising needs to be the thing, not the thing that sells the thing. Advertising needs to be the thing, not the thing that sells the thing. Explain.
Sure. Well, it goes back to this idea of interruption. I don't know if you're as old as I am, but I was raised in the generation, the glory days of 70s television. We watched Happy Days around the kitchen table, and there were a bunch of commercial interruptions. I came to watch Happy Days, but I heard about Charmin toilet paper and the Pepsi Challenge and a bunch of other ads. But today, there are 450-plus scripted shows on television alone. There are a zillion apps. There are a zillion social media platforms. There's so much content, it's unprecedented, the amount of abundance that we're confronted with. And something that comes along that we didn't ask to see is completely superfluous, unrivaled in its superfluity. So what do? When you're faced with that, do you really want to be the uninvited guest at a party, or do you want to be the party? And brands have the ability to be the party. My favorite example is the Lego movie, which is, in my opinion, the greatest ad ever made. It's a movie that made over $500 million in revenue. It's also an ad. And they should be commended for doing something in which they were the thing, not the thing that interrupted the thing.
You also talk about a term called, which I love, infobesity. Explain what that is, because that term, I'm going to be using it a lot. Infobesity.
Yeah, sure. No, I didn't create that. I've heard it many times. It's a reflection of the fact, as I said before, that we live in an economy of unprecedented abundance. There is just too much stuff. There's too much. There's going to be a Darwinian shaken out, but there's a zillion media companies, a zillion brands, a zillion platforms, and it is impossible to keep up with them. There is more content than you can consume in the waking hours of a day. And so we are suffused with this, and it puts pressure, as I said before, on anything that is not primary. So pity the fool that's secondary or tertiary. You will be discarded.
And in that is advertising. There's also other content that's just getting discarded.
Oh, exactly. I think that's, I'm so glad you brought that up. This is not just advertising. This is second and third rate television shows, second and third rate movies, second and third rate apps. There is a upside in all this, which is a kind of Darwinian flight to quality. Only great scales now. So recently, this film Wonder Woman opened. It's meant to be a very, very good movie. The word was put out, and the thing's a massive hit. Conversely, there are movies. The word goes out that it's a piece of crap, and they tank immediately. And there is no marketing that can turn a piece of shit into Shinola.
Well said, like the ad man you were.
Thank you.
So there's another term that you use several times in the book, and I want you to explain it for the listener. And that is, you say that advertising, back to history, sorry, advertising that leveraged authenticity wrapped in utility almost always worked.
Yeah, well, authenticity is a very important characteristic right now. We see that in unfortunate tribulations of that Pepsi spot. And something that actually helps you is also authentic. This came out of another story in the book. If you want to get into it, we can reference that.
But yeah, please.
The interesting origin of aspirin and its twin brother, heroin, which were both invented.
Yes, that's right. Let's get it out there. Bayer, the fine German company, inventors of heroin. And it was right within a month of inventing aspirin?
Two weeks. Yeah.
And then they put all their support behind heroin.
That's right.
And put aspirin on the show.
Because heroin
was...
that's
not on the Bayer website, evidently?
No. They've redacted that from history. I tried to get them to talk, but they will not acknowledge that.
I loved that story. Please tell it.
In the 1890s, if you went to your local Duane Reade or CVS, the shelves were full of products, which were sort of folksy remedies and snake oil, which were mostly made of alcohol and opium. And into this world came great German scientific engineering, the ability to create solutions made from organic materials. And there were three inventors, who first made a solution from poppies and named it heroin. And then they made a solution from the bark of a tree and they named that aspirin. Now, the theory behind heroin was that this pure product created with great purpose was going to cure the cough, the terminal cough that you found in tuberculosis. And heroin was really the greatest cough medicine ever created. It just had this unintended consequence of being highly addictive. But it was rooted in the authentic belief and real genuine utility. Mm-hmm. And they marketed it that way. Same with aspirin. Just turned out that one had sort of an unfortunate characteristic.
Right. Being a little addictive. Okay, yeah, so changing channels here. See what I did?
Yep.
So my friends who work in television, you know, ad salespeople, they'll say, yeah, but you know what? Live sports. Andrew Essex, why is advertising on the NFL the bane of your existence?
Well, first off, they're right, because live sports is the other big anomaly in this business. Live sports will always have advertising, as far as I can see, because live sports bring together massive groups of people and really are structured to have interruption. You could argue that the NFL was formed when Pete Brazel helped the league understand how to create breaks that would accommodate advertising. So, but the game is designed to have pauses that allow for advertising, unlike an episode of Breaking Bad.
I just didn't realize how few minutes are actual. You said you did a study. There was a study you referenced where it's like it's 13 or 17 minutes of activity in a 3-hour game, and then what, 11 minutes of replays?
That's right. Yeah, it's amazing. But so sporting events are basically vehicles for advertising, which allow for about 5% of actual action.
Right.
But you asked me why it's the bane of my existence.
Yes.
Because it is the definition of the lowest common denominator. So on the NFL, because it's a mass platform, you get a lot of mass brands that are creating mass messages, and it's like stepping into a time machine. The one exception is the Super Bowl, of course, but for the other 364 days a year, they produce really, let's be honest, with a few exceptions, second-rate spots, unimaginative and lazy work designed to speak to that couch potato.
And aired repeatedly
over and over again at a kind of level of interruption that's sadistic. And I think that they will need to figure out a way to be more disruptive, more entertaining, or they will face some kind of repercussions somewhere down the line. But it's the most resistant to change of any format.
Okay, now their ratings were down last year, at least at the beginning of the season, I think. What was going on there?
Yeah, that's probably slightly above my pay grade, but the theory is a lot of different factors. So you have a world in which the average NFL viewer is now susceptible to everything from Snapchat to the increased relevance of the NBA to every other thing pulling at their limited attention span. And then the league sometimes just has an off year where there isn't a bunch of really cool meta narratives, some backlash, the concussion thing, a lot of factors contributing to potentially jeopardize the hegemonic power of the NFL. But if I was the NFL, I wouldn't be too worried.
Okay, good.
Just everyone else. There's the NFL, Facebook, and Google, and then everybody else.
Okay, super. Okay, so if you're not the NFL, Facebook, or Google, and we've established the problems, we've probably got some ad people heading out to happy hour early. Tell the story about City Bike.
Sure. Well, you began with an excerpt from the book, which I appreciate, and we were talking about context. Question of where an ad appears. And I remember a line from a book that always stuck with me, the theft of the reader from the writer. And I think you're seeing the theft of the canvas from the advertiser. So let's begin by reiterating that the 30-second spot is going away, except in live sports, because of over-the-top television and on-demand platforms. Display advertising, digital banner ads, is going away because of ad blocking. And print advertising is going away because of just the sort of unfortunate death of print. So the canvas for a good 75% of most advertising, most traditional advertising, being erased. So what's a brand to do? Citibank, a big spender in the ad space, was looking at different opportunities, trying to be more relevant, dealing with the implications of the financial crisis, and was presented with an idea that was essentially unprecedented, which was to underwrite the creation of a massive bike sharing program in the city of New York. And they looked at this as an advertising opportunity. They could put their logo and brand colors on a fleet of some 6,000 bikes in the biggest city in the world. And they thought of it as their out-of-home advertising campaign. They shifted some money from a lot of the traditional canvases and said, let's think of this as a bunch of moving billboards, but that also reduce people's carbon footprint and give them cardiovascular exercise. So they created an entirely new canvas for their advertising. They painted on a canvas that had never existed before and created something that contributed something meaningful to humanity rather than most advertising, which
is the exact opposite, pollution, which adds absolutely nothing to people's lives. And I applaud that as still what I think is the greatest advertising campaign of the 21st century.
Terrific. Now, contrast that with Jägermeister. What are they doing wrong?
Well, okay. I don't want to sound like an elitist here. I'm not fully versed on the wonders of the product, so I'm not going to speak to that.
But. Well, I should state that I lived in Germany for 3 years, and I did extensive product research on a number of their alcoholic beverages, so I'm familiar with it.
Okay, good. So you're well versed in the product, and let's agree that it's a fine product.
Yes.
Tasty, artisanal, very cool graphics. But they engaged in what used to be called spots and dots. So like many small to mid-sized brands, they had a limited advertising budget. So they put up some posters in the subway with a bunch of people frolicking at a party in an incredibly contrived and inauthentic way, and then put the line, "Be the Meister," underneath that. And you, so you were a guy in advertising, and again, I'm deeply sorry if I'm hurting anyone who spent their life coming up with this campaign, but yes. It's just, it's kind of a classic advertising moment where someone sells a line in a meeting to a client, there's some high fives, they put out the posters, and it contributes literally nothing to the universe. And you might see a 2-minute uptick in sales while the media is in market, and as soon as the ads go down, the sales go back down.
Yes, I've seen that movie 1,000 times.
Yes. So they engaged in block and tackling, and no one will be admitted into the Hall of Fame for that campaign.
Right. So one last question about the book that I thought would be really helpful for the listeners is you quoted Jim Stengel, the former longtime chief marketing officer at Procter & Gamble, that, you know, back to my earlier question, he said there were, you know, marketers still need to make people aware and they're still going to have to sell something. But he said that selling would no longer be about telling. It would be about standing for something, about communicating a sense of purpose. See, what does he mean there?
That's a really good question. He means that if you are overtly selling something, if you are shilling, if you're engaging in jazz hands, you are working too hard at the end of the day. You're basically trying to trick someone to pay attention. Whereas if you're engaging in something that is purposeful, that is authentic, that is meaningful, that adds value, you're going to create a sense of warmth. And although there are no real ways to prove this yet, there is an intuitive understanding that brand love equals brand volume. Well, I'll give you a specific example, and you can kind of laugh at this or not, but at the Tribeca Film Festival, we started to celebrate great content from brands. So in addition to feature films, short films, documentary films, we celebrate films from Madison Avenue, or what we used to call Madison Avenue. And I had the
concept
pleasure
of Madison Avenue.
Right, exactly. Right. And from Brandland. And there were a bunch that were submitted, really beautiful ones. And there are two that stay with me. One was from the company called Square, the payments platform started by Jack Dorsey of Twitter. It was basically about this Syrian immigrant who couldn't find any work, who started a falafel stand and couldn't get banked. So he used Square to get paid and grew a business, classic American dream story. And there was another film by, of all brands, Smirnoff Vodka, about a deaf choreographer who taught other deaf people how to dance. And both of these films were beautiful and skillful, and purposeful, and as good as anything you'd see on HBO or Netflix, and made me feel very warmly towards those brands to the extent that I rethought of them and would want to use their product. Now, if they had tried to shill me or interrupted me with something else, I might feel negatively towards them and maybe be disinclined to use their product. Mm-hmm. And I believe that many other people behave the way I do.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? It reminds me of somebody sent me a LinkedIn request, and next thing I knew, they were shilling me. They were pitching me.
How'd you feel about that?
Well, I removed the connection. But what really works is when somebody says, hey, you know, here's something that might be helpful for your business. They're leading with utility.
That's right.
And so it's it comes in all shapes and sizes. Last thing I wanted to mention was that at the end of the book, a wonderful crescendo is the 10 principles for better advertising. And very tied together very nicely, and we're not going to go through that. Folks can buy the book and thoroughly enjoy reading it. Andrew, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
I think it's just the idea that you don't get ahead by annoying people. It seems so obvious. It's hardly a trenchant observation, but the model of banging people over the head to get noticed is officially out of commission.
Amen. But let me ask you, it's my sense that there's still this muscle memory or this impulse to want to do that. Even though you can present the facts, people are like, I hear the word, we want to blast it out there. We want to buy 150,000 email addresses. We want to get it. It's like you're asking a right-handed batter to start batting left-handed, and they can't do it.
Well, there's probably a bunch of people still using 8-track tape recorders too, somewhere out there. So it's the tension between the present and the future, between the evolution and the revolution. I think it's inevitable that a lot of those old models just won't work anymore.
Yes.
So
yes.
We'll hope for the best.
Yep. So Andrew, what books have inspired your work and career?
There have been a bunch over the years. A lot of them are not really in the sort of the nonfiction space, but
there's a book. That's fine.
There's a book that that really stayed with me called In the Context of No Context, which was written by a New Yorker writer named George Trow in the 70s and 80s, and really kind of anticipated a lot of these issues. That's one that's lesser known that I would highly recommend. It's a short little essay, and it's really kind of life-changing.
Interesting. I didn't know that one. I'll make sure to include a link to it at marketingbookpodcast.com on your show notes.
Excellent.
How best can listeners learn more about you and your new book?
Well, I think please follow me on social media. I'm pretty active on Twitter, and I'm very responsive to anyone that has a question. Just ping me, and we'll be friends forever. just don't sell me anything.
Okay. The name of the book is The End of Advertising, Why It Had to Die and the Creative Resurrection to Come. The author is Andrew Essex. Andrew, thank you very much for being on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that closes the book on episode 127 of the Marketing Book Podcast. Links to everything linkable in the interview you just listened to are at marketingbookpodcast.com. And that's also where you can sign up for the Marketing Book Podcast newsletter so you never miss an episode. And to register for Content Marketing World, just go to marketingbookpodcast.com. Click on the Content Marketing World banner so they'll know I sent you. And for the very best price, enter promo code MARKETINGBOOK. And if you have any feedback on the show, I'd love to hear from you. Just go to marketingbookpodcast.com and leave a message or tweet at me. My Twitter handle is marketingbook, or connect with me on LinkedIn. My name again is Douglas Burdett. And please join us next time as we welcome Laura Bush to the show to talk about her new book, Powering Content, Building a Nonstop Content Marketing Machine. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast. Hey, Andrew?
Yep.
I'm picking up some noise of paper.
Sorry, I was counting money.
Very good. I like it.